National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, I'm Leah Caribbean, and this is the National Gallery Podcast. Coming up, a painting you can hear as well as see, courtesy of the Royal College of Music. And
I think, you know, a big part of what is contemporary art is surprise, challenge. The word shock sometimes, I think, is a little bit overused. But I think it's definitely about making people go, yes, I haven't thought about that before. And I think that is the important thing that contemporary art can do.
Turner Prize winner Grayson Perry on what's next for Trafalgar Square's famous empty plinth. But first, it's January. Time to make and probably break those New Year's resolutions. Whether it's learning a language, consuming less caffeine, or going for early morning runs, becoming the person we'd like to be can involve more willpower than most of us can muster. But Louise Govier of the education team thinks the famous and rather fabulous subject of one of the gallery's portraits might provide some inspiration. Miranda Hinckley went along to find out more.
Well, we're shown this very nice, matronly-looking lady, quite strong, looking out directly towards the viewer. But she looks absolutely as if she is someone who is very cultured, but very happy to stay at home and engage herself in womanly work. She's surrounded by things that tell us that she is learned. She's got a bookcase with a whole set of beautifully bound books. She's got her beautiful piece of furniture that holds all of her different embroidery threads. We've got a portfolio of prints. She's an art collector. And a mandolin. She enjoys music too. And also, of course, this lovely little dog, one of her pet dogs, an ideal way for her to show that she's still faithful to the king. She looks, though, as if she hasn't got a thought in the world, and that's not the whole story with Madame de Pompadour. Rather than have everyone thinking she's still involved in foreign politics, she shows herself as a nice matronly lady who likes to stay home and do the sewing. It isn't the reality, though, because actually she used her embroidery sessions as a way to then meet with important people who wanted to get to the king. She actually sort of brokered those kinds of arrangements at her tambour frame. So when we look at this woman looking as if butter wouldn't melt in her mouth and she's just happily embroidering, we have to imagine that we're actually a French courtier who's desperate perhaps for the king's ear. We have to get through this lady first.
So she was obviously a very adept political manoeuvre and someone who was used to using her image to kind of convey different ideas about herself. How has she used her image in other ways?
This woman is used to using portraiture as a way to reinvent her image. She literally makes herself over every couple of years according to the needs of the day. To start off with, when she's having a sexual relationship with the king, she's portrayed as Diana, the virgin huntress, although everyone knows she's not a virgin and the only thing she's hunting is the king. Then at different points, she shows herself as an intellectual, actually looking as if she's written part of the Encyclopédie, the big encyclopedia project. She shows herself as a nice lady who's involved in gardening. That's at one of the times when she needs to take herself back a little bit from the public stage. One of the points when she's arranging for the king to have other lovers other than herself, she actually has a portrait made of herself as a Turkish sultana, the woman in charge of the harem. She has this put over the bedroom door, so the king must have had to look at her every time he went in with the latest young thing she'd chosen for him. There's a particularly wonderful example where she actually makes her self-image over into a virgin. She has herself portrayed as a Vestal Virgin at the age of 40, which is quite something, and everybody knew she wasn't a Vestal Virgin, but it was a way of showing her ongoing devotion and fidelity to her king. And one of the things I love about this painting is that Madame de Pompadour is in charge of the whole process. She is a woman who is incredibly proactive, not just about her own self-image, but about her life overall. She always takes charge. She always looks where she's going and moves on to the next step. And I just think that's a great inspiration for us all.
Thanks to Louise Govier. It being the season for fresh starts, Miranda also went to meet a woman who's an expert on helping people make them, Heather Harris, a professional certified life coach from Red Resource. Miranda began by asking her what Madame de Pompadour's masterful control of her very complicated life could teach us today.
Heather, Madame de Pompadour's personal and private lives are both very complicated, and yet somehow she always stayed in control. Obviously, most of us don't have her notoriety, but is there something that we can identify with here?
I think she actually demonstrates something very interesting
It's an approach and an outlook that shows she's very willing to take responsibility for her own life. We all actually have the choice to lead our own lives. It's sometimes hard for us to see it that way, but we do have to ask ourselves, if our life doesn't look like the way we want it to be, what changes are we willing to make? I think she absolutely got very clear about that.
So it's very much about responsibility.
Definitely. Many of us will make circumstances in life the reasons why our life looks like it does and it isn't exactly what we want. But the question we really need to ask is, how much of that is really an excuse? We always can do something. I think that's quite empowering.
So January, time to make a new start, a great time of year for making changes. What are simple things that people can do to start to take control of their own lives?
One of the simplest things we can do is look at what we're saying yes to and what we're saying no to in life, because essentially, when it boils down to it, that is what's going to dictate the shape of our life. Many of us say yes when we really ought to be saying no. Many of us regret saying yes to things. We find ourselves overwhelmed, and we find ourselves without the things in life that we really wish we were doing. So a simple monitoring exercise of what am I saying yes to that really ought to be a no, and what am I saying no to that actually ought to be a yes, is a good place to start. Related to that is a question about what would you like more of in your life, what would you like less of in your life. In many ways, that can give you the signpost to what your yeses should be and what your noes should be. We all have limited time and energy, and we deserve to have the things in our life that we want.
That's lovely. Thank you very much, Heather.
Heather Harris, ending that report by Miranda Hinckley. Inspired? Well, if New Year means it's time for a new you, come along to the gallery. We're holding lunchtime talks on the theme of reinvention throughout the month. They're free to attend, and Louise Govier will be talking about Drouet's portrait of Madame de Pompadour at 1 o'clock on Tuesday the 29th. See our website www.nationalgallery.org.uk for details. Now, looking at pictures of people singing and playing music can be an uncanny experience. We know they're making a noise, but all we can hear is the quiet of the gallery. Unless, perhaps, we're looking at Matteo Di Giovanni's extraordinary Assumption of the Virgin, an altarpiece that's positively awash with angels making music. It's one of the highlights of the Renaissance Siena exhibition, and with just a few weeks to go before the show closes, James Hurd of the education team wants us to hear as well as to see it.
I'm with Bridget Cunningham, and we're here in the Royal College of Music. We're actually in the museum, which is a stunning collection of musical instruments. But the reason we're here is we're preparing for a concert on January the 2nd. And in the National Gallery, there is a wonderful painting that happens to be in the Renaissance Siena exhibition. It's an altarpiece by Matteo Di Giovanni. It's very large, and it shows the Virgin Mary ascending into heaven. And what is special for us about it is she's surrounded by, I think, about 20 angels, and they're all playing musical instruments. And the idea is to assemble these instruments and let our audience know what they sound like. So I'm going to hand over to Bridget, because she's the expert on all this.
It should be very exciting. We will have a kind of collection, a lovely selection of different instruments from the altarpiece, including a portative organ, rebecs, a lute, recorders, many percussion instruments, including knackers, a cymbal. So it's a real collection of instruments, both the soft type and the kind of louder instruments, such as the shawm and the organs, which are depicted.
We're going to have this concert in the theatre, the National Gallery, and we're going to project the painting onto the screen behind. And Bridget is actually going to talk about the instruments, and we're going to show close-ups so everybody's clear what the instruments are, and then we're going to have the concert.
Absolutely, yes, and we will talk as we go along and explain how the instruments work and how they're different to modern instruments that we know today, and then play some of the music from the time from Siena. There'll be four musicians, four of us playing, so we're going to alternate instruments, all playing completely different ones. So I think I'm playing the organ, psaltery, harp and percussion, and we'll just kind of switch as we go along. So it's just a matter of remembering where we should be at the right time.
With Bridget is Laura, who is going to be playing some of the instruments. Laura, tell us which instruments you're going to play now.
Well, I'm going to be playing a selection of recorders on the day, but at the moment I've got a tenor recorder with me. It's a little bit different to the sort of recorder that you might be familiar with seeing children play in schools, which is actually a much later 18th century style recorder. This one has a much wider bore and a much fatter, fuller sound at the bottom, but a narrower range as well. So it's much more of a consort instrument.
And the organ I'll be playing on the day is very, very different to the organ we know today. With my left hand, I actually pump the bellows myself, and in the right hand, I actually play the keyboard, the melody. So it's a very, very different instrument. It's very small with one row of pipes, just one rank of pipes. It's a very, very lovely vocal sound.
Do we still have the music from that period?
We're very fortunate to have found, well, and still have many manuscripts from music from the time, which we will be playing from on the day.
Well, thank you, Laura and Bridget, and looking forward to January the 2nd. Can't wait. Thank you.
Thanks to the Museum of the Royal College of Music. The concert takes place at 6:30 on Wednesday, the 2nd of January. Tickets cost £5 or £3 for concessions and are still available. If you can't make it along, do check back with the gallery website. Evening concerts and lectures are regular features on our events calendar. Finally, you can download a full version of the piece played by Bridget and Laura as a bonus track with this episode. Next up, monuments are usually the preserve of dead military heroes and government grandees, but in recent years, Trafalgar Square's empty fourth plinth has offered artists a chance to reinvent this most traditional of forms. Thomas Schutter's Model for a Hotel 2007 currently takes pride of place in the square, but the process of choosing the next featured work is already underway, and a new exhibition at the gallery offers visitors a sneak preview. From the 8th of January, we'll be able to see the ideas proposed by the 6 shortlisted artists, who include Anthony Gormley, Tracy Emin and Anish Kapoor. Colin Wiggins talked to Turner Prize winner Grayson Perry, a member of the judging panel, about what makes the fourth plinth such a unique site.
Grayson, thank you very much for talking to us, and also thank you very much for your work on the panel of the fourth plinth. Now, that's what we're interested in knowing. Being part of a panel, one imagines there can be all kinds of heated discussions and conversations through the night and everything. How did you find it, being a panel member?
I think the media would like it to be a sort of dramatic sort of fist fight, but it wasn't really. There was general consensus pretty quickly, really. It wasn't a long, drawn-out process to choose the shortlist. I mean, we'd put the tender out to quite a lot of artists and several international artists, and I was a bit disappointed that one of the foreign artists didn't end up on the shortlist. But what we looked for in the end were pieces that we thought would work well in the context of Trafalgar Square.
Within that context, what do you think are the unique challenges of designing a piece to be shown on that plinth in that location?
Well, it's going to get an awful lot of attention for starters. Then you've got the sort of practical things. I think the most important thing, though, is knowing what Trafalgar Square means to British people. I mean, it might not be the prettiest square, you know, but it is the square of kind of public discourse, if you like. It's also full of kind of slightly dated military heroes. And I think sort of knowing those things informs the ideas of the 6 shortlisted artists.
And, of course, your work, at first glance, maybe from 20, 30 paces away, your work looks quite safe and conventional with traditional forms of pottery, but you get nearer and start to look closer, then smack in your face, you find these very subversive, dangerous images. Do you see the square as a kind of parallel almost to your work, with it being on one level very conventional and safe, but then within it an artist has a chance to be dangerous and subversive?
Yeah, I think it can work very well like that. I mean, I think the Mark Quinn piece worked like that, because probably out of the corner of people's eyes, it did look like a conventional marble statue. But then I think when people looked at it, they realised it was far from that. And I think that is definitely an opportunity for an artist in kind of subverting what it is to make public sculpture. I think, you know, a big part of what is contemporary art is surprise, challenge. The word shock sometimes, I think, is a little bit sort of overused. But I think it's definitely about making people go, Yes, I haven't thought about that before, and I think that is the important thing that contemporary art can do.
Grayson Perry. The fourth plinth exhibition runs until the end of March, so if you're in Trafalgar Square, pop in and see the contenders before the pigeons get their say. Admission is free. That's all for now. Join us again next month when Miranda Hinckley will be back in the chair to give you all the latest news of the National Gallery's exhibitions and events. Until then, goodbye.